The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Though the story had been orally told for many years before, the French peasant folk tale La Barbe Bleue was first published in print form in Paris in 1697 after it was written by Charles Perrault, the father of the fairy tale. Many iterations of this grisly story about an aristocrat, a powerful nobleman feared for his cruelty, have been written since. This man's unsightly blue beard is the source of his name in the story. This nobleman was married several times, but no one knows what became of his many wives. Mysteriously, they all disappeared. Though Bluebeard wishes to wed one of the two beautiful daughters of his widow neighbor, neither will agree. He was much older than them, and they feared the man and his ugly facial hair. After attending an extravagant banquet party at the extraordinarily wealthy man's home, however, the youngest daughter changes her mind. The allure of a life of riches and luxury is too powerful for her to resist. Bluebeard and the young woman are promptly married after she agrees. Not long after the ceremony, Bluebeard tells his new bride that he must embark on a long journey to conduct business. The palace and everything within are hers to do with as she pleases, he tells her, save one thing. As he places the keys to the majestic home in her hand, Bluebeard tells his young bride she may use them to open any casket containing jewels that she wishes and any room, except one. At the end of a great hallway, there was a door leading to a small closet, and Bluebeard told his wife entry into that room is forbidden. The man leaves on his journey. Like the wealth that led to her agreement to marry Bluebeard, the allure of the forbidden door is astounding. When the temptation becomes too strong to resist, Bluebeard's wife hurriedly makes her way to the forbidden door and opens it. But it's no small closet, like her husband told her. Rather, it's a large room with shuttered windows, the floor awash in blood, and the corpses of Bluebeard's many murdered wives arranged against the walls. In her shock, Bluebeard's young bride drops the key in the blood, retrieves it, and leaves the macabre room. Though she tries desperately to clean the key so her husband won't find out what she's done, the bloodstains won't come off. Bluebeard just happens to return that same night. The next morning, the nobleman demands his wife return the keys. After examining them closely, he asks why the one key has a bloodstain. The woman denies any knowledge of the blood, but Bluebeard becomes angry and tells his new bride that she must now take her place among his other wives for her betrayal. The young woman, however, tricks Bluebeard by asking for time to make peace before he slays her. She calls for her sister, who brings their brothers. As Bluebeard is about to swing his sword against his wife's neck, his young bride's brothers kill the man, and all is well, as his recent widow inherits his great fortune. The origin of this bloody and terrifying cautionary folk tale has been heavily debated, as has its precise moral. Though several real-life figures are thought to be the inspiration for this story, those figures also seem to be surrounded by unfounded lore of their own, products of history passed down by word of mouth, embellished just a little more, perhaps, with every generational retelling. Without a doubt, the circumstances differ significantly from the French folk tale, but there have certainly been many real-life Bluebeards throughout history. A great deal of folks in Houston, Texas, in fact, believe a man named Dean Goss is among them. But besides the strange vandalization, burglaries, two accidental shootings, and three violent deaths that surround this man, there are just as many other bizarre circumstances and shady characters lurking in the background that cast at least some reasonable doubt about Dean Goss's role as the Bluebeard of Houston. Dean Neil Goss was born in Dallas, Texas on April 19, 1936, to James J.D. and Bonnie Goss. The boy's name was taken from his father's middle name, Dean, and his stepfather's middle name, Neil. After graduating from Sunset High School in Dallas, the same school his father and uncles attended, Dean went on to study at Southern Methodist University there. Now, Dean would later become known for telling some pretty tall tales, and his college football days are often among the stories the press later claimed he fabricated. More than one report says that Dean wasn't listed anywhere as a player at SMU, but he was, and it was incredibly easy for us to find proof of that. It's right in the university's annuals. His position was tackler. Anyway, at 6 feet 2 inches tall and around 300 pounds at the time, Dean Goss was certainly built for the gridiron. All the Goss boys, it seems, grew into big men. His father, J.D., was 6 foot 3 and weighed 295 pounds. His uncle, Wilson Goss, 6 foot 2, 195 pounds. Dean's uncle, Roland Goss, was nicknamed Stormy during his celebrated high school football career, as he was known to storm the field. Stormy was 5 foot 11 and weighed nearly 200 pounds. He was scouted by several NFL teams, but when Imperial Japanese Navy planes bombed Pearl Harbor, resulting in the United States joining World War II militarily, Stormy opted to join the Navy and leave behind a career in football. Dean's uncle, Robert Goss, however, did see a career in professional ball. At 6 foot 5 inches tall and 260 pounds, Robert's nickname Tiny was obviously meant to be ironic. He played for the Cleveland Browns starting in 1956 for 2 seasons, before being traded to the New York Giants, where beloved future Dallas Cowboys head coach Tom Landry was working as a defensive coordinator at the time, the Texas Legends' first coaching gig. Tiny Goss retired after suffering a knee injury. For whatever reason, Dean Goss never played football past college. Instead, Dean bounced from job to job in an attempt to avoid working alongside his father at the family business, Goss Aircraft Supply, located at Love Field Airport in Dallas. But Dean finally ended up taking a job at Goss Aircraft Supply, and though most of his time there is lost to history, there is one unlikely tall tale that the man often told concerning his time at his father's company. According to Dean, in 1959, a gun-running friend of his introduced him to the newly sworn-in Prime Minister of Cuba, Fidel Castro, to whom Dean Goss proceeded to attempt to sell airplane parts to. It's highly doubtful that Castro would have discussed such matters with a 22-year-old gringo like Dean, but that's the story he liked to tell. When Dean Goss was 23 years old, he married 21-year-old Elaine Richman, the daughter of successful North Dakota farmers. After the ceremony up north on February 28, 1960, Elaine and Dean returned to Dallas. They started their family fast, welcoming 2 baby boys into their lives over the next 3 years, Dean Jr. in 1960 and Craig in 1963. In early 1968, Dean, Elaine, and the kids moved south to Houston, where her parents had purchased the young family a remarkably nice faux-Tudor two-story home. The home was located in the affluent Meyerland neighborhood, located in the city's southwest. Dean and Elaine Goss were still young. He was 32 and she was 28, but the two had big plans for Houston. Just a few months after the move there, they became an incredibly popular couple in H-Town, and their future, at least for a while, was looking bright. This summer is shaping up to be at least a partial return to normality. I'm certainly looking forward to hitting up a honky-tonk or a punk show, maybe get my friends over for a cookout and a few beers for the first time in over a year. Sounds refreshing. What leaves my old noggin feeling like summertime is the mobile puzzle game, Best Fiends. It leaves my brain feeling refreshed and recharged, like it just did a few laps in the pool. I'm currently on level 4245, so needless to say, Best Fiends isn't easy for me to put down. The levels have gotten significantly more challenging, which is exactly what I like, and every level has a different strategy than the last. If I feel so inclined, I can sink myself into the game and lose track of time, which means I'm also losing track of whatever is stressing me out at the moment, whether it's the dull day job or the dark places I find myself in while working on this show. One of my favorite things about Best Fiends is changing up characters and attempting a different strategy if I'm not doing so hot on a level. There's a lot more than that to love. So download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. In 1968, the Holiday Dinner Theater opened at 2525 Merworth Drive in Houston, Texas, and it was an instant hit. In the heart of the South Main District, referred to at the time as Houston's mini-Vegas Strip, the Holiday Dinner Theater was the dream child of tall tale-telling, larger-than-life former Dallasite Dean Goss and his talented wife, Elaine. The location was ideal. Just across from the theater was the Houston Astrodome, or the Domed Stadium, as I'm told real Houstonians prefer to call it. Just down the road was the hotel of choice for visiting celebrities and various other bigwigs, the Shamrock. Opening night was on Wednesday, August 7th, 1968. To a full house, the performance of Barefoot in the Park, a play by Neil Simon that saw a successful film adaptation the year prior, starring Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, went off without a hitch. Besides the performance and an entertaining introduction and closing by Holiday Dinner Theater's charismatically sardonic host, Dean Goss, guests were treated to a gourmet dinner, which included a choice between three main courses, 18 salads and sides, bread, and a dessert. While dinner is served, the play's actors mingled with patrons, as did the attentive and charming owners. The establishment became incredibly popular fast. A couple years later, the Holiday Dinner Theater was renamed after its founder, becoming the Dean Goss Dinner Theater in 1970. Dean and Elaine also welcomed to the world their third baby boy that year, Andy, and Dean landed a bit part in a movie starring Shelley Duvall called Brewster McCloud. He played the part of Officer Ledbetter. Dean and Elaine, in fact, often played roles in the productions at the Dinner Theater. Throughout the life of the Dean Goss Theater, which became known as the eighth wonder of the world around town, there were ups and downs. But it was a big deal nearly the entire time. And so was Dean Goss, who became known around town as Houston's Jackie Gleason. For those of y'all who don't know, Jackie Gleason was an incredibly popular actor, best known, perhaps, for his role in the television series The Honeymooners, or his inimitable role in the 1961 film The Hustler with Paul Newman, in which Gleason himself actually made all of his character's trick shots at the pool table. Dean Goss was a hulk, tall and large-framed, and though Gleason was several inches shorter and weighed significantly less than Dean, usually, his presence on camera often made him appear larger than he was. Dean Goss, in fact, was quite a bit heftier before he underwent intestinal bypass surgery, his 450 pounds reduced down to about 300. Both Dean and Gleason smoked fat cigars, and Dean's baritone, dry, and deadpan delivery of monologue before the theater served dinner was very Gleason-esque, with a little of the famous insult comic Don Rickles mixed in. In his monologues, he cracked wise and off the cuff to the audience, poking fun at both unknowns and big names alike, such as oil tycoons and politicians. the latter of which opened their wallets to have Houston's Jackie Gleason berate them publicly. Dean's style and choice of material would be considered wildly offensive by today's standards, but the butts of his jokes loved it, and he evened out the playing field with self-deprecation, often poking fun at his own weight by comparing himself to the Astrodome or a volcanic mountain when he wore his bright red blazer, striped with purple and black. Dean was a bona fide Houston celebrity, promoting his theater by entering barbecue cook-offs using his own sauce, called Rustler's Choice, the tagline of which was, "The sauce good enough to steal." He entered and won a watermelon seed-spitting contest. Dean wrote screenplays and poetry in his spare time, had a brief stint as a local radio personality, and he lived as large as he let on. Often, Dean picked up dinner tabs for his important guests and gave money to actors out of work. He bought he and his wife the finest clothing and expensive jewelry. Plenty of folks disliked Dean Goss's tall tales, but even more ate them up and encouraged it, even as they knew the man was either wildly exaggerating or downright embellishing. From tales of discovering gold mines in Mexico to meeting Fidel Castro, the man always had an unbelievable story to tell. He was an expert bullshitter. Jackie Gleason's nickname was the Great One, anyway, but Dean Goss held that title in Houston, and the man was hobnobbing with the city's social elite. Elaine and Dean were not millionaires, but they were welcomed with open arms into Houston's high society. They rubbed elbows with socialites and local celebrities and called virtually every city leader and politician by their first name. But, as I said before, life was not without its ups and downs. Tragedy struck Dean in 1972 when his mother Bonnie died of cerebral arteriosclerosis, the hardening of the walls of the arteries in the brain. Bonnie had suffered headaches, facial pain, and impaired vision for some time as a result of this disease, but apparently at the time doctors believed a certain psychosis was also associated with it. Dean's mother died while in the Terrell State Hospital, a public psychiatric hospital located in Terrell, Texas. Her death was a great blow to Dean, but he moved forward with his great success. All things considered, he, Elaine, and the three boys were doing well. In 1973, Dean landed another small role in the film The Thief Who Came to Dinner, starring the great Ned Beatty. But that high was short-lived. Not long after, the landlady who owned the building that housed the Dean Goss Dinner Theater raised the rent exorbitantly. The building was owned by Candace Mosler Garrison, or Candy, who infamously carried on an incestuous relationship with her nephew, Melvin Lane Powers, with whom she was accused of planning and carrying out the overkill by stabbing death of her husband, rags to multimillionaire financier Jacques Mosler. If you listen to the two-part preface of this series, you're already well acquainted with Candy. Now, Candy Mosler Garrison was rich, and you don't get richer by doing folks favors, I guess. But there may be more to her raising rent on the Mosler Company's Houston properties than just that. Since the famous Percy Foreman, the lawyer who represented her at her and her nephew's murder trial, was suing the woman because she never paid him the fee she owed for that trial, maybe she was trying to cushion the financial blow by raising the rent on the properties. Plus, she fought Foreman for a couple years for whatever reason, so presumably her legal fees were incredibly high. And to top it all off, her stepson had sued her for mismanaging his slain father's estate. The Texas Supreme Court told Candace Mosler Garrison in September of 1973 that she must pay Percy Foreman the fee she owed. Just a few months before this decision, Candy told police in Miami that an intruder broke into her hotel room and stole $200,000 worth of fine jewelry. That's the same amount she owed Foreman, by the way. The cops labeled Candy's report as a hoax. Anyway, the hike in rent put a huge dent in the money Elaine and Dean Goss were making from the dinner theater, even considering the place was still a popular Houston night spot. But they eked by, at least for a few more years. In 1977, Dean Goss landed another incredibly small role in the family film For the Love of Benji, the second movie in the Benji series. Dean plays a man in line, his smallest role yet. Other than bit parts in three films, Dean Goss couldn't get his acting career off the ground. He also continued writing and submitting screenplays, though no producer ever picked any of them up. In the early 1970s, the United States' domestic production of oil, largely in the form of gasoline, was declining, but demand was rising. This problem is complex and way too much to get into here, but as a result of what has been called the late 70s oil bust, attendance at the Dean Goss Theater fell to a trickle. Perhaps foreseeing the theater's downfall in the near future, Dean Goss tried his luck at politics. In his 1979 bid for city council, Dean concentrated on Houston's growing problem with crime. He pointed out that the city's crime rate had reached epic proportions and that a greater presence of law and order was needed, and that was a popular opinion. But even still, and like his attempts at acting and screenwriting, Dean failed to make waves with his stint as a candidate for public office. By late 1980, Dean and Elaine Goss couldn't pay food and drink distributors, and as a result, lawsuits against the business, among everything else, forced the theater to close for good. Vowing that he'd never work a 9-to-5 job, Dean Goss tried his luck at stand-up in Las Vegas, Nevada, but his routine was met with mediocre reviews, and he couldn't fill a room. It was a low point for both him and Elaine. Their passion project, which had been so successful for over 10 years, was gone. But the blow to Dean's pride was particularly devastating. He'd been one of Houston's most popular attractions for a decade, and everything was over. And he had to break the promise he made to himself. Dean Goss was forced to go back to the daily grind when he reluctantly took a job as a salesman for an advertising company. But fate had something far more tragic than the loss of a business in store for the Gosses, when less than a year and a half later, Elaine was murdered in cold blood. Before marrying Dean Neil Goss, his wife was named Elaine Karen Richman. She was born in Tower City, North Dakota, on July 11, 1938, to parents Henry and Virginia Richman. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about Elaine's life before her time with Dean. We do know that she was the daughter of farmers, and that she was a band member at Tower City High School, where she graduated. She was also prone to accidents, perhaps a bit clumsy, as there are several stories about Elaine that prompted Dean Goss to write a play based on both that subject and what some say was her hypochondria. The play was titled God Bless Mommy, Daddy, and Blue Cross. Elaine broke her foot and tailbone while pregnant with her and Dean's third child, Andy, after a fall in a parking lot. Once at the home of Houston professional basketball executive and sports writer for the city's newspaper, Mickey Herskowitz, a taxidermied swordfish fell off the wall and onto Elaine, causing a spinal injury.
My wife never met a health policy she didn't like or an accident that could pass her by, was one of Dean's lines in his play's script.
Elaine Goss had an impenetrable sense of humor, luckily, and was more than fine with her husband poking a little fun. In fact, she loved Dean's Jackie Gleason of Houston status and kept a journal of sorts filled with his jokes. Though prone to clumsy falls and unlucky circumstance, Elaine's death was no accident. On Tuesday, March 16, 1982, at around 5 p.m., Dean Goss pulled into the driveway at he and Elaine's home in the Meyerland neighborhood of Houston after his day at his sales job. He walked into the house and chatted briefly with his second-born son, Craig, who was 18 years old at the time and in the kitchen alone when his father came in. After Dean spoke with Craig, he headed upstairs to his and Elaine's bedroom. In the study to the side of the room, Dean Goss discovered his wife Elaine on the floor, lying face up in a pool of blood. He quickly called the Houston police. Upon arrival at the Goss home, detectives inspected the death scene, after which they traveled room to room in search of clues. At the rear of the house, a window leading to the den was shattered. Shards of glass laid on both the inside and outside of the window frame. The broken window was certainly an oddity, since, also at the rear of the home, two doors were unlocked and ajar. Odd, or perhaps suspicious. Craig was at the house when his father arrived, so naturally, detectives wanted to speak with him. But, Craig told them, he'd only arrived home at about 4:20 p.m., about 40 minutes before his father, and he'd not seen nor heard anything. At autopsy, it was determined that Elaine died as the result of a .22-caliber gunshot wound to the back of her head, at close range. She'd been murdered several hours before she was found. Although Dean Goss was broke, and even far behind on the debts he owed, the man wished to provide his wife an expensive and elaborate funeral. To do this, Dean scraped up what he could, and to supplement most of it, borrowed $4,000 from local businessman Frank DeMaria. Elaine was still active in civic and high society activities when she died, and Dean gave her a grand funeral that included fleets of limousines for the guests. 43-year-old Elaine Karen Richmond Goss was buried at Memorial Oaks Cemetery in West Houston. In what was perhaps a deadly mistake, Dean Goss never paid back the $4,000 that he borrowed from Frank DeMaria. Remember that name. Although nothing was missing from the Gosses' Meyerland home, Houston police detectives weren't quick to rule out robbery or a burglary gone wrong as the motive for Elaine's death. In fact, the headline breaking the story in the Houston Chronicle read that she was shot by a burglar. There may have been a more strategic reason for this headline. Perhaps the cops purposefully misled the press so that the subject of their number one theory might also be misled. Though he was not their number one theory, detectives' first order of business was to look into Elaine's husband. But Dean Goss had indeed worked the entire day, and any small window he might have had to run home and murder his wife was accounted for. Dean was off the hook, and the cops zeroed in on his son, Craig. The 18-year-old became the prime suspect in his own mother's murder. To this day, in fact, he remains the only suspect ever named in the long, cold case. Craig Goss admitted that he'd lied to the police about when he got home. He didn't arrive at 4:20 p.m. at all. He'd actually skipped school and had been home since the early afternoon. Craig told detectives he never saw his mother, he never even went upstairs, nor did he see the unlocked, open back doors or the broken window. But he did see something that seemed peculiar to detectives, though not so much to Craig. In the Goss home on the day Elaine was slain, the rifles Craig kept on a gun rack in his bedroom were found laid out on the living room carpet. Craig told detectives that he just thought his dad, or another family member, had put them there in the process of marking them for identification, in case they, God forbid, end up having to use them to protect their home. Now, this may or may not have raised the cops' eyebrows, but in Craig's defense, there had been a rash of burglaries and break-ins in the area recently. So the teenager's claimed thought process concerning the rifles was believable. Although the Houston police never released the results of Craig's polygraph examination, Both of his brothers, Andy and Dean Jr., later told the press that the test showed no signs of deception. Detectives never determined a motive for Elaine Goss's murder, nor did they find any evidence that clearly pointed toward a suspect. The case remains unsolved to the day of this recording, in July of 2021. Dean Goss struggled both financially and emotionally after the death of his wife. The man was flat broke, and although he attempted to revive some semblance of a career in local show business by opening a magic show at Houston's Bel Air Theater, his attempts ultimately failed. Rose Malone, who'd acted in productions at the Dean Goss Dinner Theater, joined him on that venture, and later told the press that it was Dean's last attempt at a life in entertainment. He had ideas, but he was broke, unemployed at that point, and his credit was terrible. Dean couldn't fund any of his potential ventures. The man was lost and floundering in almost every way imaginable. Then Dean Goss met Paula. Presumably looking to downgrade, Dean Goss began looking for a new home in late 1983. While doing so, he met an extraordinarily successful real estate agent named Paula. She owned her namesake company, Paula Malone Real Estate Agency Incorporated, which she had started in 1978. Paula was 39 years old when she met 47-year-old Dean. She played piano and was the mother of two boys, whose father she was in the process of divorcing. That divorce was finalized in February of 1984, and the woman barely had time to breathe before getting caught up in a fast-moving romance with the former Great One of Houston. Paula was obviously smitten with Dean's charming, charismatic, and larger-than-life presence, both considering his personality and physicality. He told friends that he fell over the moon in love with her, damn near immediately. Some, however, believed that Dean's infatuation with Paula had more to do with her bank account than an actual love connection. Just more of Dean's bullshit, they said. It's unclear what Dean's detractors based that notion on, it must be noted. Whatever the case, Paula was interested in getting Dean back in the game, and she threw $150,000 his way to do it. That's a lot of money in 1984. Dean and Paula were married at a lavish ceremony in April of 1984, and that same month, the couple opened up Dean's newest brainchild, a restaurant called the Dean Goss family's Cattleman's Cove. Since Dean Sr. owed a lot of folks a lot of money, 22-year-old Dean Jr.'s name accompanied his new stepmother's on the official business papers. But everyone knew that Jackie Gleason of Houston was the boss. Cattleman's Cove was located at 6935 South Main Street. Not only was the building just across from what used to be all the rage in Houston for visiting celebrities like Frank Sinatra and Howard Hughes, the Shamrock Hotel, it also once housed the popular Valiens, the city's beloved cowboy-themed Italian restaurant. Dean, it seemed, was back. Things were finally going his way. But it didn't last long. In fact, among business problems, two violent murders of folks close to Dean were still to come. Before we get into those tragedies, however, it is perhaps important to discuss the Houston businessman from whom Dean Goss borrowed money for his first wife Elaine's funeral, but never paid back. So, before continuing with the story of vandalism, two accidental shootings, and murders surrounding Dean Goss, we're going to take a little detour to tell the story of Frank DeMaria. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information on the murder of Elaine Richmond Goss, please call Houston Crime Stoppers at 713-222-8477. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, And for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the co-ed killer, Dr. Dreadful, the Butcher Painter, and our latest there, the Tourniquet Killers, parts 1, 2, and 3, among others. Just to let you patrons know, we have mailed out some thank you gifts to those of y'all at the Bomb City and above levels. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us at Patreon. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. The Houston Press, KVUE.com, The Houston Chronicle, The Austin Statesman, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.